The Mars Helicopter's Mimi Ong, this week on Planetary Radio. Welcome. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society with more of the human adventure across our solar system and beyond. Many thought it couldn't be done, but the team at the Jet Propulsion Lab and their partners kept at it for years. You've seen the result. As we publish this week's episode, Ingenuity has completed 5 flights on the Red Planet, each of them more challenging than the last. A portion of my conversation about this triumph with project manager Mimi Ong is moments away. Want to win a snazzy Planetary Radio t-shirt? Your chance has finally returned with this week's What's Up segment. Bruce Betts also has pointers for viewing the upcoming total lunar eclipse. Bye-bye, Bennu. OSIRIS-REx captured one last image of the asteroid it has been orbiting as the spacecraft began its journey back to Earth, carrying a precious cargo of asteroid material. The snapshot leads the May 14th edition of The Downlake, where you can also learn about the 2-year trip ahead. You probably know that China's Long March 5B rocket, the one that carried the first segment of its new space station to low Earth orbit, came down safely in the Indian Ocean. But did you see MSNBC's Rachel Maddow talk with me about this uncontrolled deorbit? There's a link to my appearance at planetary.org/downlink. Lastly, there's this also in the downlink. Hear that hum over the Martian wind? That's the sound of Ingenuity's rotor spinning furiously at about 2,500 RPM. The recording was made by the Perseverance rover during the helicopter's 4th flight on April 30th. No one was prouder or happier to hear that whirr than Mars Helicopter Project Manager Mimi Ong. She joined me online not long after Ingenuity's 5th flight for the enthusiastic conversation you're about to hear. Mimi, welcome back to Planetary Radio. Congratulations to you and the entire Ingenuity team on the magnificent success of this little flying machine. We are all blown away out here. And really, thanks for coming back.
Thank you. Thank you for cheering us on.
We definitely do that. Can you believe the attention that the Mars helicopter has been generating for weeks now?
Yes, it's humbling and it's energizing and it's just amazing support. So really, really grateful for that. Thank you.
It is such a pleasure. It really is inspiring. And it's that power to inspire that I think we may talk about toward the end of this conversation. 5 flights completed now. As we speak, I mean, by the time people hear this, you may have completed 6. And we'll ask you what's coming up in a moment. But I just wonder, how is Ingenuity holding up? You're already have more than met your goals, right?
Ingenuity has been impressive, I have to tell you, just impressive. I think we're all speechless. The reason is, right, we have been really modeling, thinking what Mars is like, right? I mean, really deeply thinking, reflecting them in the models, starting from the atmospheric models to thermal models and the environment. Until models for launch, you know, for landing, but then really also surviving the night and looking at the energy models. And then on top of it, do we have enough energy to fly? And then all the frequencies on the vehicle, you know, all the vibrations. And I mean, every area you can think of, it's been highly interdisciplinary. So as we were building and testing the vehicle, it hasn't been just about flying. You know, it really is about, as you spin up, what are things happening? You know, how is it taking off? And then what are the currents? What are the voltages? What are the temperatures, right? And even on the days that you're not flying, the telecommunication link, and do we have enough energy to survive the night? That was one of the biggest worries of our team, right? After deployment, yeah. Does it survive the first night? Well, it looks like everybody in that tiny little 1.8 kilograms, everybody had managed to tuck in a lot of margins up their sleeves, I have to tell you.
That's so typical of you people at JPL. Rovers run forever and helicopters that just keep on flying.
Yeah, I know. But, you know, given how tight we were in mass and just every watt hour that mattered, it has been amazing. I mean, starting all the way from you know, the survival of the first night. When you look at the predicted range of where the temperature should be versus where the dot of the actual measurement, they're right on now, you know, just nailing the temperatures. And then how much energy they need has been modeled so well now. And we're coming out of the nights like with very good, healthy state of charge. And we are back over 90, 92, 93, higher the state of charge by midday, which is, you know, the peak was predicted to be maybe to take till 2 p.m., you know, Martian, local Martian standard time. Well, we are, you know, by noon or so, we're well in the 90% state of charge. We had gone from, ooh, we better wait, you know, until late enough to fly the energy to, wow, decent, middle of the day. We can fly anytime to exactly the way we have always seen it, you know, the whole time we were testing, you know, if you really kind of look at it. So we are controlling the altitude to a centimeter when we're up at 5 meter flight, you know, and the heading, you know, to 1.5 degrees, you know, after we're landing. It's just been phenomenal. So I guess Ingenuity had been ready for its training wheels to have been taken off long before we were ever ready to let it go. I mean, and hopefully you saw, right, especially the flight 3, when the first time Ingenuity actually flew out of the MASCMZ field of view, that was incredible. I mean, we had the poor thing has been trapped in our chamber or this little area that we've been letting it to fly, and it's finally like, I'm flying, you know, and so it's been impressive, really impressive.
I don't know about you, but on that flight, when it flew out of the frame, it was like, oh my God, oh my God, please come back, please come back. And of course it did. So by that time you knew, right?
Yeah, my feeling was, you know, for me personally, it was like, wow, it's finally getting to fly the distances that it was designed to. That's what I felt. I felt really happy that it's, because it's, you know, and so far, I mean, the last trip was, the flight 4 was 270 meters, you know, round trip. And so, yeah, it's designed to fly hundreds of meters. And so I just feel very happy that it's finally flying the distances it's designed to.
So what's next? You've got more flights now planned, right? And in fact, Perseverance is sticking around to monitor these to help out for a little bit longer than was originally planned.
Yes. So next, yes, we have our technology demonstration 100% batch. So we're very proud. So technology demonstration is complete. NASA has given us 30 days, the new 30 days, to do operational demonstration. So now we really go into the regime of what operational regime of having a rotorcraft on Mars along with a rover. It is about looking at cases of, you know, scouting or aerial observations of sites, you know, that are not reachable by rovers, or scouting ahead of, you know, a helicopter or, you know, future rovers, or from aerial vantage point, making 3D stereo products, you know, that we can take from by taking images from above, you know, as opposed to from a rover that we traditionally do. So we're looking at these kind of products. And so we are working with that. The big change is that Perseverance is now gone back to their primary science. I mean, you know, Perseverance has an extremely important science project, and we've been really lucky to get all of their attention for the month of Ingenuity. So now the difference is we're working wherever we can interleave our operational demonstration. And then the second is we are also getting guidance from Perseverance team, the operational and the science folks, on suggestions on products and operational scenarios that would be useful for future missions. Because, you know, since the Perseverance team is really hands-on, you know, they have the really firsthand insight and foresight into, hey, when we build the next generation of missions, right, these are the kinds of operational scenarios and products that would really complement science that's being performed by a rover. So it's a very exciting phase.
I wonder, on behalf of a lot of people, I bet, has there been consideration of having Ingenuity tag along as Perseverance heads out across Jezero Crater? Or would that just be too much of a distraction from the science that Perseverance has to do?
I think it'll fall in the latter. Ken Farley is the project scientist, and he and his very global, extensive team have really carefully designed the science. That design doesn't include the use of, you know, Ingenuity for that. And so It would be really the cooperation, the collaboration that we're doing now is really with our eye together towards future science missions. That's one. And then second, you know, as we were talking earlier, Ingenuity can only last really the spring and the summer. And then when it gets too cold, Ingenuity is not sized enough as a tech demo. Now, future helicopters, different story, will be able to last a long time. But Ingenuity, the way it's built, cannot last once the cold temperatures start to come in.
Let me follow up on that. You talk about future helicopters. Are you or others already taking what's been learned and starting to think about more ambitious flying machines for the red planet? And I wonder now if next time a rover goes to Mars or someday humans, do you have any doubt that they're going to have rotorcraft along with them?
Well, the second question, you know, future rotorcraft on future missions, I certainly hope so, but that's a great question for Dr. Sabukin and, you know, Dr. Laurie Glaze. And I think, everybody's very excited, and I'll leave it there. But definitely, you know, the Science Mission Directorate and Aeronautics, you know, Research Mission Directorate, this is a very exciting topic. So I think it's a great topic. And we're all very excited about having aerial vehicles complementary to, you know, rovers on the surface, and of course, complementary to spacecraft continuing to be on orbit. So definitely, I think adding the aerial dimension is just opening up a whole new regime. In terms of now research and technology development, what's the next generation? Yes, there are a lot of, again, from the research and technology development side, a lot of excitement about now next generation rotorcraft. So a couple that I'm aware of are, for example, JPL partnering with Ames and AeroVironment, looking at, you know, the scaling. You know, we are only a 1.2 meter diameter rotor system right now, right? So scaling up to 3.5 meters diameter rotor system, talking about 15 kilogram kind of a vehicle carrying a couple kilogram, 1.5, 2 kilogram payloads. Then it becomes a very serious exploration system. Those activities are definitely, the collaboration is continuing in the pushing the research and technology venue. Yeah, we have a great running start.
If you extrapolate that scalability out, can you or has anybody else imagined a day when a rotorcraft on Mars could maybe carry a human? That's an awfully big jump, I know.
Yeah, the current analysis show we cannot go that far on Mars. Other planetary targets, yes, you know, Titan, of course, Venus, of course, has a, you know, environment. There is thick atmosphere, but at Mars, the atmosphere is too thin, really. So the limits of about 3.5 meter diameter. After that, the dynamics, the floppiness of the blades, you know, all of that start to come in, and then you're starting to fight with the mass constraints. So really, the vision for Mars is effective aerial vehicle to really get to places you can't get to, and to really, you know, partner with science exploration and human exploration.
I'm going to come back to where we started, and that is the inspiration that Ingenuity has provided, maybe especially for young people. How important is that part of this project to you? I mean, you've proven machines can fly, rotorcraft can fly on Mars, but I mean, you look at the world reaction, and there are kids out there right now who are just blown away, and who knows, maybe deciding that they want to do something like this for a career.
They are inspiring me, because I think it really is, because it is unexpected. Most of us tend to be very humble, and we have our heads down, and we like to make things work. And taking on the Mars helicopter, which was considered almost impossible, that almost challenged us to work like crazy. We all worked a lot. Our team worked an incredible amount, really driven by this. We believe it's possible based on the algorithms and, seeing that, where the challenges are. And yes, it's not easy, but there was no way we were going to be told that it was impossible until we absolutely couldn't do it, right? And so at least personally, when you kind of say, our team is inspiring everybody, I feel very humble, and I'm inspired by I'm really inspired by the public that really has the foresight and also the instinct and the insight to really see that this was an accomplishment. So I just feel very grateful and honored to be even said that we're inspiring everyone.
I do want to mention there are great ways for kids to get involved on the Mars Helicopter website, including you can make your own paper helicopter. I'm even more impressed by this Mars Helicopter video game, where apparently kids, or big kids like me, can actually do coding and kind of become a Mars Helicopter pilot, at least on their own screen, their virtual helicopter that they can run at home. This is really cool stuff.
It is. And, you know, one of my colleagues from another project, Venus Activity, he actually texted me like his young daughter did a video game. It's just really impressive, you know. So, yes, just go for it, everyone. You know, I guess what I want to say to the new generation is our team just did a Pathfinder. Okay, it's just a proof of concept. It is not the ultimate flying machine, but it is something for your generation to really take it to the next step, you know, make it bigger and fly further and longer and, you know, do more capable things. And just one example, if we have a bad landing, you know, on Ingenuity, it would be the end of the mission. Well, your next generation, you need to put a self-righting system, but it has to be very lightweight. So it's not like you can just tag on a self-righting system. It's got to be very clever, lightweight system. Many other inventions that have to follow. So I really leave it to your generation. You got to make it much greater than we are just the start. We're just the Pathfinder. So please take it all the way.
I hope we've got young people out there listening right now who will take you up on that challenge as soon as they can. I hope that you and the team have taken a little bit of time recently to celebrate this marvelous success of the Mars helicopter, Ingenuity, and best of continued success with the flights that are still left to us before Perseverance moves on, looking for evidence of past life on that red planet.
Thank you so much, and thank you so much for cheering us on.
Mimi Ong is project manager for the Mars helicopter, Ingenuity, at the Jet Propulsion Lab in California. As usual, Mimi had much more to say than we have time for here. You can hear our entire conversation on this week's episode page found at planetary.org/radio. I'll be right back with Bruce Betts and What's Up. This is Planetary Radio.
Bill Nye, the planetary guy here. The threat of a deadly asteroid impact is real. The answer to avoiding it? Science. And you. It's the only large-scale natural disaster that could one day be prevented. The Society is getting ready to award its next round of Shoemaker Near-Earth Object Grants to talented astronomers around the world. You can learn more about this opportunity and our other work at planetary.org/neo. We're just trying to save the world.
Hi, I'm Kate from the Planetary Society. For all its troubles, 2020 has still seen some terrific space accomplishments. We asked our members and supporters to vote for their 2020 favorites. You can see the results at planetary.org/best of 2020. We're talking about the best solar system image, the most exciting moment in planetary science, and much more. That's planetary.org/best of 2020. Happy holidays from the Planetary Society.
Time for What's Up on Planetary Radio. We are back with the chief scientist of the Planetary Society. I got something for you right up front here from Christoph Hertel in Norway, who says, thanks for the show. I can't follow Bruce's night sky advice because it won't be dark here for the next 3 months.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that. I'll work on that. But I will point out that the sun is up in Norway, and you can check it out at all times of day. Don't even in Norway, don't stare at the sun without proper filters. But yeah, check out that sun.
They're really smart in Norway. I'm sure that they would not stare at the sun. But it's a good reminder.
I'm legally obligated to say that.
That's good, actually. What else is happening for those of us who aren't stuck up there near the Arctic or the Antarctic for that? I guess the Antarctic, they're doing well right now with stars.
A little brisk, a little chilly out. Well, I want to mention something not night sky or maybe night sky related, which is to remind people that our new grants program, that's the STEP grants, Science and Technology Empowered by the Public. If you think you've got a good idea, a good project, and can justify it in all the right ways, go ahead and check out planetary.org/step grants. One word, step grants.
Anybody can apply for these?
Anyone can apply. Yes. Got a tie to our core enterprises. So exploring space, finding life, defending Earth from things like asteroids. So it has to fit into that category. But anyone can apply. But obviously, we're looking for things that we that not only fit, but that are credible and will do something good in leaping forward in science and technology in those areas. Night sky. So sorry, Norway. Actually, sorry, half the world, because the first thing I'm going to talk about is the total lunar eclipse that is coming up on May 26th, and it is for areas that are around the Pacific Ocean, so the Western North America, South America, Australia, Pacific Islands, Japan, China, etc. You can check this out if you're on the western side of the Pacific. It'll be in the evening. And if you're on the eastern side of the Pacific, it'll be in the pre-dawn, in the morning. And it'll be a relatively short for a lunar eclipse totality. It'll be about 15 minutes because the moon is passing through kind of one edge of the Earth's shadow. It will probably be reddish, but it depends on the atmosphere because of the red light getting refracted through the Earth's atmosphere, making it through the blue light scattering away. And if you're watching the news, you will see it referred to as a super blood flower moon. I guess flower kind of super blood flower moon. Flower moon is a traditional name derived from the Native American Algonquin tribe for the full moon in May. Blood moon is what they like to call it because it turns red. It is a super moon, which is when the moon is at full moon is closer to Earth in its elliptical orbit. So it will be slightly larger than your run-of-the-mill average non-super blood flower moon. And there are also planets up, unless you're in Norway, in which case you can check out Jupiter looking super bright over in the east, Saturn to its upper right, and in the evening sky, very low in the west, you've got super bright Venus, very low, and above that, Mercury and Mars up in the southwest in the early evening. Whew! Okay, we move on to This Week in Space History. Also, a very busy week in space history. A few highlights. 1961, 60 years ago, John F. Kennedy gave the We Should Land on the Moon speech that led to the Apollo program. 8 years later, 1969, Apollo 10 got to within about 16 kilometers of the lunar surface as it did a dry run without landing. But wait, don't order yet. 2008, the Phoenix lander landed on Mars in the polar region. In 2010, Icarus was launched, which became the first solar sail mission, a precursor to LightSail and our first solar sail mission in a tiny spacecraft. It's a lot. There's so much, but I'll be short in the next segment. Random space fact. On average.
No, wait. You can't just go on like that. I'm not even sure I can apply the right level of reverb to that. You got to hear this comment from Matthew Walter in Louisiana. Does 950 episodes with Bruce mean that he's created a new random space facts pronunciation 950 times? If so, he deserves a medal. Maybe we need an episode to explore this and other planetary radio lore. I don't know. I think you were in line for that Nobel for 950 pronunciations, but I think you blew it on this one.
Oh, I've ruined my chance.
That's all right. Matthew would probably give it to you.
I can redo it. It was a different pronunciation. That was all that I really strive for.
That's true. It was unique.
Well, so much for a short random space facts segment to pick up time. But here's your short random space fact. On average, Neptune is about 78 times farther from the sun than Mercury.
That's very good. On average, of course.
Mostly because Mercury's orbit is quite elliptical. Let's go on to the trivia contest. I asked you, on Michael Collins' second EVA, extravehicular activity, and this was on Gemini 10, by the way, what did he collect from the Agena target vehicle, and what unrelated item did he lose during that EVA? How'd we do, Matt?
You tripped up so many people, but you laid it out for them because you were looking for an unrelated item. And a lot of people came up with a related item to what he collected. Here's Dave Fairchild, our poet laureate, to give the correct answer. With Collins and Young safe on board at the launch, the Gemini 10 took a ride. They caught up in orbit and rendezvoused with it, Agena, and parked close beside. While EVA floating, he pulled off the fairing and gathered the meteor pack. And yet when he entered, attached to his tether, his camera didn't come back. That's what you were looking for, right?
That was indeed. Lost the Hasselblad camera that he had. And a micrometeorite collector is what he pulled off and brought back from the Agena target vehicle.
Congratulations, Bert Caldwell in New York. Longtime listener, I think, but a first-time winner. Hasselblad 70mm camera, and I guess Collins was pretty broken up about that. He thought he'd gotten some pretty great good shots. We are going to send Bert a copy of Andy Weir's new novel, Project Hail Mary, that you heard me raving about 2 weeks ago, and I continue to rave. It is that good. And I'm hearing from some of you about how much you're enjoying the book.
Yeah, I just thought I'd fill in that indeed they lost another collector that floated out of the cabin, but that was a meteorite collector pulled off the actual Gemini capsule, not from the Agena target vehicle. And indeed, that is why I said unrelated. All right. What is the most massive star? Massive. What is the most massive star within 10 light years of Earth? Go to planetary.org/radio contest.
Wow. I know that there are some big, big boys out there, but within 10 light years, interesting limits set on this one. You have until the 26th, that'd be May 26th at 8 a.m. Pacific time, and we're going back to the Planetary Radio t-shirt.
Yay!
Our good buddies at chopshopstore.com who designed it and work with us because that's where the Planetary Society store is. They pointed out that they got some of these in inventory. We're going to have one for the winner of this contest, and we may give these away for a few more weeks. They are very stylish. I know you feel that way because I saw you wearing one in a Zoom session yesterday.
That is so true. I wear mine every day.
Oh, that's good to know, and I'm glad we were in a Zoom session. Say goodnight, Bruce.
Good night, Bruce. All right, everybody, go out there, look up in the night sky, and think about what shirt you would wear every day. Thank you, and good night.
Okay, you won me over. Planetary Radio t-shirt. Gotta be. He's Bruce Betts, the chief scientist of the Planetary Society, who joins us every week here for What's Up. Bruce wants you to know that there is much more about the upcoming lunar eclipse at planetary.org/night-sky. We'll also put a link on this week's show page at planetary.org/radio. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by its members who sometimes feel like they're flying the friendly skies of Mars. Mark Hilverde is our associate producer. Josh Doyle composed our theme, which is arranged and performed by Peter Schlosser. Ad Astra.